This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A week from tomorrow, we vote. Today we look back on a past political era and one of the politicians who dominated it.
Vote early and often for Curly. He's bound to go places, they say. He's going to be mayor, and the chances are fair that he'll sit in the state house one day. His voice is as rich as a fruitcake. Bill Shakespeare, he quotes with a vim. He charms all the voters like birds in a tree. He sounds like a guy with an Oxford degree. It's 50-1 that our next mayor he'll be. Our royal purple shamrock. So mark your ballots for Jim, for him. Just mark your ballots for Jim.
That campaign song sang the praises of James Michael Curley. He was elected the mayor of Boston four times in four different decades, the 1900s, the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. He ran for mayor 10 times in all. His last run was in 1955, just 3 years before his death at the age of 83. He was also elected to the U.S. Congress four times. My guest Jack Beattie has written a new biography of Curley called The Rascal King. Beattie is a senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine. Curley's life was fictionalized in the novel and the film The Last Hurrah. Beattie says he wanted to reclaim Curley for history. I asked Beattie what era of politics Curley represents.
He represents the tumultuous political era stretching from the turn of the century, in his case up until 1950. He brought with him through his career the infectious enthusiasm of 19th century electioneering, when turnout typically reached over 80% in the North. Curley brought that tradition forward into the 20th century. He did it with his brass bands, with his Rococo rhetoric, with his passionate advocacy for the poor, and with his undiminished and undimmed, as the years went on, vehemence of attack against, in Boston, the Protestant ascendancy.
You write that Curley's name was synonymous with Boston Irish and Boston politics. You know, even JFK had to surmount his legend. And you also write about the divide in Boston politics between upper-class Protestant politics and working-class Irish Catholic politics. What were some of the fundamental differences in the conception between those two groups of what politics should be?
There were different conceptions of the ends of government. To the upper class Yankee Protestants, government was all about setting neutral rules. You set neutral rules of procedure, people obeyed them, and outcomes came out as they would. You didn't deal with outcomes. To the Irish, on the other hand, politics was all about helping people. Politics was all about jobs. Politics was about the needs of daily life. There's an anecdote that sums this up vividly. A Beacon Hill lady was stumping for her candidate in Irish South Boston, and she knocked on a door and made a passionate plea for this person. And the Irish woman in South Boston said, "Well, doesn't such and such have a sister who works in the schools?" And the Beacon Hill lady was shocked. She said, "Are you implying patronage? He wouldn't do anything like that." And the South Boston lady replied, "Well, if the son of a bitch wouldn't help his own sister, why should I vote for him?"
So what did Curley give people who voted for him? What did they get for their vote?
In the first place, they got jobs. They got patronage. They got the sometimes literal turkey for Christmas and sometimes its metaphorical equivalents. They also got a voice to echo their resentments. Their resentments stemmed from the fact that Boston was in steep financial decline, steep economic decline throughout the Curley era. Curley rose as Boston fell. And the Irish, especially in Boston, were full of thwarted aspiration, class resentment. And Curley gave these passions, some of which were mute, they couldn't be openly avowed. He gave them vivid and memorable expression in his Brahmin baiting, in the constant attack he mounted against the forces of privilege in Boston.
You grew up in an Irish family. Your grandparents were Irish immigrants. I'd like to know what Curley represented to Irish voters, but let's start with what he represented to your family. Did your family talk much about Curley?
He was a hero of my father's, who would imitate Curly, and my uncle gave a memorable Christmas Eve rendition of the Curly voice, which was an extraordinary verbal instrument. Indeed, not since the womb of time would deliver William F. Buckley Jr. would Americans hear such an affected torture of the larynx. Curly was extraordinary. So his voice, both his real voice over the radio and his and the renditions of my uncle and father, that was part of our lives. But also his legend, his retorts to people, his comment upon the collapse of a bridge built by one of his contractors. He said, "Well, it was an injudicious mixture of sand and cement." That sort of one-liner that would echo down the years. All this was part of my growing up as a Boston Irishman.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jack Beattie, and he's written a new biography of Mayor James Curley of Boston, and the book is called The Rascal King. Beattie is also a senior editor at The Atlantic magazine. Now, you point out that Curley lived like a king in a mysteriously funded mansion. He was known to take a lot of graft. Did his constituency mind?
No, I don't think they did. Their view was cynical, that he delivered for them, and his munificence didn't seem to bother them. At the height of the Depression, he had in his 21-room house a staff consisting of an upstairs maid, a parlor maid, a gardener, a chauffeur, a social secretary for his daughter, and a governess for his son. This all on a salary of $10,000 a year. He took 10-week peregrinations of the European continent, bringing along a royal-like retinue of servants and family retainers, eating only at first-class restaurants, staying only at first-class hotels, smoking only first-class cigars. And in a strange way, his constituents seemed to regard this munificence rather the way Depression-era viewers must have regarded the sort of thing they saw in the Busby Berkeley musicals, you know, as some fantasy projection, as some vicarious projection. No, they didn't mind it. And in fact, there are stories of Irish ladies taking their children in prams by Curley's house and saying, "Oh, look at the grand house up there with the shamrock shutters. See that? Isn't that wonderful?" They took pride in it. It was a sort of collective achievement.
You say that Curley practiced the politics of polarization. What groups did he set against each other?
He set the Irish and more broadly immigrant groups against the established Protestant ascendancy. He made religion a political issue. In 1921, running against the unimpeachably named John R. Murphy, he charged that Murphy had strayed from his faith and become one of what Curley called God's frozen people, that is, an Episcopalian. In running against other candidates, he would always wave the Irish Catholic flag. He preyed on the resentments that were buried deep in the political unconscious of the Boston Irish, stemming from the official persecution mounted by the Protestant know-nothing governments here in the 1850s. Those were down there. Those were waiting to be preyed upon. Those were waiting to be exploited. Curley made a career of that, using issues of religion, using issues of ethnicity to achieve that political arithmetic that Mario Cuomo talked about, that addition by subtraction, that multiplication by division through which the modern Republican Party has achieved its presidential majorities up until today, when it appears that economics is trumping race as an issue.
In practicing the politics of polarization, did Curley set different immigrant groups against each other, Jews against Irish, or did he try to set Irish against blacks?
No, he didn't. To his credit, he never dabbled in anti-Semitism. He was, on the whole, a good mayor for Boston's blacks. But he did imbue his constituents, his dominantly Irish and Italian-American constituents, with what I call the habit of suspicion, blaming others for their problems. Always, in other words, his politics of scapegoating left that habit there. And when in the 40s there were anti-Semitic outrages at the time of the Holocaust in the streets of Boston with gangs of Irish boys preying on Jewish boys, Curley denounced that eloquently, but at the same time he had helped to inculcate the very habits of mind that would make anti-Semitism flourish in Boston. So it was a very thorny and paradoxical legacy on that notion of intra-group polarization.
Why do you think the kind of ethnic politics that we're talking about now doesn't exist in the same way anymore in America?
Well, in some ways, that's all to the good, isn't it? Curley lost his mayoralty in 1949. He was voted out of office, and that was the year that Shoppers World, the great indoor suburban mall, the first one in New England, opened up. And it was kind of, it sort of marked an epoch, the end of Curley and the beginning of suburbia. And suburbia, the dispersion of ethnic identities, the breaking up of urban solidarities, that has brought with it good things, I think, the end of this kind of ethnic politics, but also bad things, the end of characters like Curley, the end of a certain kind of nostalgically tinged politics that we all crave somewhat, and the end of a certain kind of identity, I think, that helped Americans feel pride in their differentness.
You learned a lot about graft in all its permutations by writing about the life of Mayor Curley of Boston. And I think you reached the conclusion that there's still a lot of graft today, but it's more legal, it's more legitimate.
Yes, it's declared. Every week, $2.5 million in PAC money goes into the campaigns of our congressmen. This year, and senators, this year, up to August, $62 million in so-called soft money, that's that money permitted by the post-Watergate reforms, has gone into the presidential campaigns of Bush and Clinton. Charles Keating of the SNL pirate had it right. He says, I'm paying for influence, and that's what these people are paying for. Our government is systemically corrupt. Tony Coelho, the former Democratic whip of the Congress, told Greg Easterbrook of the Atlantic Monthly, the process buys you out. The process buys you out. It's buying out our government today.
You pointed out in an op-ed piece in the LA Times that Ron Brown, is the head of the Democratic National Committee, is also a partner in what you describe as the mother of all lobbying firms, Patton Boggs and Blow. You said that's a scandal. What does that mean to you?
Well, I just think, and I'm not imputing any personal dishonesty or anything of the kind to Mr. Brown, who's an admirable fellow and very skillful. But you see, this is supposed to be the party of the people, that is the Democratic Party. It's supposed to be the party of the little man and woman in America, the disadvantaged, the outsiders. It can't be the party of the Washington lobbyists and lawyers. Eight people surrounding Governor Clinton in his top echelon, according to the Center for Responsible Politics, eight of them are people who've done lobbying for foreign governments and firms. That's just a fact. Now, Clinton has a good record on this in Arkansas, and he promises as president to push an aggressive reform agenda. And Bush, by contrast, vetoed this year a campaign finance reform bill that would have done much to clean up our politics, including eliminating soft money from presidential politics. But the fact is the Democrats, to get back their soul, have got to get clear of their lobbyists. They've got to, you can't have it said about the Democratic Party what Lud Ashley, a former congressman, Democratic congressman, said to Bill Grider, which was that the Democratic Party is this bunch of lawyers from K Street. That can't be. This has got to be a party of the people.
Do you think that the Republican Party is any better?
No, I do not. But you see, it's not as much an ideological problem for the Republican Party. They are the party of wealth. They are the party of business. They are the party of privilege. So it's a sort of consistent. It's not an ideological embarrassment for President Bush that Charles Black, one of his chief advisors, should be a registered lobbyist for all manner of foreign governments and firms. That's Bush favors total, untrammeled free trade, even if the other guys practice don't play by our rules. So that's not an ideological embarrassment for him. I think it is an ideological embarrassment for Bill Clinton to be, you know, surrounded by people who have lobbied for foreign governments and firms, because Bill Clinton is supposed to be standing up for the American worker, not for the foreign worker.
What was the moment in your life when you were most politically involved with a campaign? And I don't necessarily mean working for a candidate, but just that your heart was really involved in it.
Well, it was 1984. It was I worked on phone banks night after night, calling people all over New England for Walter Mondale, who represented the kind of Democrat that I most favor: pro labor, pro minorities, pro cities. And it was a sobering experience to me. I was calling places like Lawrence and Lowell, and I called this poor places. I called this one house, and a gentleman with a thick accent answered the phone and asked me, he said, what does Senator Kerry think about the abortionists? And I said, well, I'm not calling for Senator Kerry. I'm calling for Vice President Mondale. I know, he said, but what's Senator Kerry's position on the abortionists? And I said, well, sir, Senator Kerry, I understand that your bishop here in Boston thinks that abortion should be the dominant issue of this election, but the Bishop of Chicago, I read the New York Times, I'm a smart guy, I thought I'd slip that in. The Bishop of Chicago, he says that these issues, poverty, war and peace, Nicaragua, and abortion, they all form part of a seamless garment such that you can't say where one begins and the other lets off. And there was a pause, and the guy came back and he says, tell me, when this Bishop of Chicago said this, was he alive? And I said, yes. And he says, yes, you see, it's because his mommy didn't take him to the abortionists. So I had an education in the Socratic wisdom of the electorate. That was my most vivid political experience.
Jack Beattie is the author of the new book, The Rascal King, The Life and Times of James Michael Curley. Over the past 6 years or so, rock star Peter Gabriel has been best known for his soundtrack album for The Last Temptation of Christ, his world music album Passion Sources, and his work for Amnesty International. He has a new album of his own music called Us. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
I caught sight of my reflection. I caught it in the window. I saw the darkness in my heart. I saw the signs of my undoing. They had been there from the start.
Brainy, arty singer-songwriters like Peter Gabriel understand the pact they make with audiences, that they will reveal aspects of their inner lives so that fans can identify with them and savor their honesty. At the same time, performers like this don't want to reveal too much because they'll destroy some of the mystique that helps make them seem so brainy and arty. In interviews to promote this new release, Gabriel is eager to reveal that he's been spending time in analysis, in individual and group therapy. The unfortunate result on this new album is that it sounds as if Peter's been indulging his inner child a bit too freely.
And in this moment, I need to be needed. With this darkness all around me, I like to be light. And this emptiness I'm feeling, I want to be wanted. Cause I love to be loved. I love to be loved. I love to be loved. Yes, I love to be loved. I cry.
That's Love to Be Loved, whose sensuous world beat is marred by hapless whining about needing to be needed and wanting to be wanted. I cry the way that babies cry, cries Gabriel, the way they can't deny the way they feel. This is the therapeutic fallacy. My emotions are real, you can't deny them, therefore you must accept this naked honesty and approve of it. Sorry, Pete, I don't. I find your mewling kind of embarrassing. At least on another psychobabble tune, Digging in the Dirt, Gabriel has a funky beat and an even funkier metaphor for his fearless plunge into his subconscious. Stay with me, I need support, Gabriel murmurs on that song, which could also be heard as a plea to his fans not to desert him. In an effort to score a hit single to provide himself with material support, he's included a song called Steam, which is nothing more than a reworking of his 6-year-old hit Sledgehammer. The catchiest song on the album, however, is the one in which Gabriel admits to his baser needs. It's called Kiss That Frog, a pretty clever metaphor for, well, let me put it this way, he could have called it Hide That Salami.
Let me introduce this frog nest. You alone can get him singing. He's all puffed up, wanna be your king. Oh, you can do it. Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. Lady, kiss that frog.
There's some good music on this collection. Gabriel and producer Daniel Lanois have found new ways to combine their long-running interests in world music rhythms and progressive rock melodies. But too often, the music is obscured by the star's self-absorption. He may have called this record Us, but that's just because he knows the jig would really be up if he called it by its true title. Me, 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 me.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.